I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we know that minorities have been hard hit by the effects of the recession in everything from employment to foreclosure rates. There's a new office within the agency that's been charged with looking out for consumers that's supposed to take a look at how financial practices affect minorities and women. We'll speak with the new head of that office in just a few minutes. But first to the issue of marriage equality, which has been in the news of late. Vice President Joe Biden attracted headlines with comments he made recently suggesting he now supports same-sex marriage, and citizens of several states are taking up the issue again. But if there's one moment in this ongoing debate that seems to have captured the nation's attention, it was this one.
In my 19 years, not once have I ever been confronted by an individual who realized independently that I was raised by a gay couple. And you know why? Because the sexual orientation of my parents has had zero effect on the content of my character. Thank you very much.
That was University of Iowa student Zach Walls, whose remarks before Iowa lawmakers urging them not to pass a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage and civil unions became an internet sensation. In the year since that speech, Zach Walls has taken a break from college to travel the country advocating for same-sex marriage rights, and he recently penned a book, My Two Moms, Lessons of Love, Strength, and What Makes a Family, and he's with us now to tell us more about it. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michelle. I really appreciate it.
When did you realize that this had become a thing?
There were a few different moments that kind of led me to that realization and that decision to really be there that night. You have to remember this is back in January 2011. This is on the tail end of that string of suicides that began in September of 2010 with the death of Tyler Clementi out in New York City and sparked a number of suicides that unfortunately led to the deaths of dozens of young gay and lesbian kids. There was also the fact that in November of 2011, Iowans voted out of office the three Supreme Court justices who were up for what's called a retention vote in this state. And then after that, there was this push by Iowa Republicans in the House to pass this constitutional amendment, HJR 6, which they like to dress up in this cloak of democracy and letting the people vote, but was in reality an attempt to, in the first time in the history of the state of Iowa, codify discrimination into the law of the land. And then it was kind of understanding, the impacts that those would have on me and my family and other kids who have gay parents. It was like, okay, you have to stand up and you have to say something. And given the opportunity, it was one that I wasn't going to pass up.
So when did you realize that your testimony had had that kind of impact? I mean, it's become a cliche, but it literally did go viral. I mean, there were more it was downloaded more than 2 million times like in a matter of days.
So when did you realize
that it had become an internet sensation, as we said?
Yeah. Well, in the first week, it got 1 million hits, and by the end of the year, it had about 20 million hits and was the number one political video of 2011 on YouTube. And the moment of realization that I had when I realized that something big was kind of about to happen was actually when I got a Facebook message from an ex-girlfriend of mine who said that she had seen the video on Perez Hilton's website. And I'm not like a huge pop culture guy, but I knew that that was a big deal. That was, kind of the moment where I had this like, oh, wow, this is about to blow up. And then 10 minutes later, I was talking with the producer from The Ellen DeGeneres Show.
What is it that you think people are responding to?
Whatever the stereotype of two lesbians raising kids is, a clean-cut engineering student, Eagle Scout entrepreneur from Iowa probably isn't that stereotype. There's a lot of kind of shock factor in that. But more to the point, I think a lot of people, in when you watch that video, you really do see the love and the commitment that I have for and to my family. And I think a lot of people connected with that because it reminded them of their own love and their own commitment that they have for their own family.
The book is organized. You mentioned that you're an Eagle Scout. Mm-hmm. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
That's the highest rank of that you can attain in the Boy Scouts. Mm-hmm. And it's organized along the kind of each chapter is one of the values that the Boy Scouts teaches or hopes to impart. And one of the things that you talk about in the book is how your moms, despite the fact that they're two moms, did prepare you and help prepare you to be the man that you are today. Could you talk just a little bit about that?
Yeah, so each chapter is named after one of the tenets of the Scout Law, one of the most important pieces of scouting lore. So trustworthy, loyal, helpful, and there are 12 of these values. And so my mom's every night around the dinner table, my sister and I, and them included, would have to share an example of that night's value. The fact is that when it comes to raising kids, the important thing isn't whether or not you have a parent who is a male and a parent who is a female. The more important thing is whether or not you have a parent or parents who is or are willing to put in the effort that it takes to instill good values into your kids. And I think, you know, this is the 21st century. We can all agree that there's nothing inherently masculine about courage or discipline, and there's nothing inherently feminine about kindness or respect. These are universal values that define not necessarily a good man or a good woman, but a good person. And that is a lesson for which I'm very, very grateful to have learned from my moms.
There's also the element of parental sacrifice, and there is the fact that the Boy Scouts of America have fought all the way to the Supreme Court for the right to, if local chapters so choose, to keep gay people from being scout leaders. How did that go when you went to tell the moms that you wanted to become a Boy Scout?
It's not just gay people either, Michelle. It's also atheists. Nobody doubts that the Boy Scouts of America have this right. They certainly do have the right to do so, but right to do so and whether or not they should do so is another question altogether. I mean, when I ran home from kindergarten that day really wanting to join the Tiger Cubs, the very lowest level of the totem pole, they were initially, I think, a little taken aback. But it also made sense. You know, they spent a lot of time outdoors themselves, and so it made sense, I think, to them that I wanted to spend time outdoors. And so they were very open and very honest with the Cub Scout pack when they went to that first meeting and said, look, here's who we are. We're not going to pretend to be something we're not. Is this a problem? And I think the Cub Scouts appreciated that openness and that honesty, and they said, nope, as long as you're not causing any problems, and they didn't, we don't have a problem. And so not only did they not have a problem, when they needed another adult leader, a den mother, Jackie, my short mom, volunteered and actually became one of the most revered den mothers of the entire pack. And then when they needed an interim pack master while they looked for a new long-term replacement, Terry, my tall mom, stepped in and was that interim pack master. And what I took away from that example was after you actually sit down and you get to know people like my mom and you have this face-to-face conversation, it becomes much, much more difficult to discriminate against them once you learn that, you know, they really are interested in the same thing as you.
You know, that seems to be in part what the vice president was saying. And if you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. And I'm speaking with Zach Walls. His new book is called My Two Moms, Lessons of Love, Strength, and What Makes a Family. You might remember him because his testimony before an Iowa state legislative committee became an internet sensation a little more than a year ago. And he's written a book about that experience and what happened after. I mentioned that Vice President Joe Biden grabbed headlines this weekend for some comments that he made. Here's what he had to say.
I am absolutely comfortable with the fact that men marrying men, women marrying women, and heterosexual men and women marrying men are entitled to the same exact rights, all the civil liberties. And quite frankly, I don't see much of a distinction beyond that.
Over the last 3 years, Vice President Biden has been a surrogate for the president and gone to a number of these dinners. And so it's a well-known fact that he has met a lot of same-sex parents and their kids. You know, it's also very important for your listeners to remember that this is this very same vice president who in 2008, during the vice presidential debate with Sarah Palin, stood on that stage and told the moderator that he and President Obama were publicly opposed to same-sex marriage. So this is an incredible development, really, in terms of where the Obama administration falls on this issue. And I would not be surprised to see the Obama administration publicly announce support for same-sex marriage before the convention.
There are people who truly and apparently with integrity do believe that same-sex relationships are against nature, against God, mm-hmm. that nothing good can really come of something that is against nature. What do you say? What do you do with that?
There is no doubt that they have the right to hold that opinion. But when we have these conversations, I try to stay courteous. I try to make sure that if they have a sincere question, that I answer it and that I'm willing to be upfront with them about who I am and what my own biases are and really talk it out. I think there's a very fundamental misunderstanding between a lot of folks in that community specifically who are opposed to same-sex marriage and people in the LGBT community.
Who do you hope will read this book?
there were really two audiences that I kept in mind while I was writing. The first was other kids who have same-sex parents. And I wanted to make sure that, you know, I was speaking to them as a peer, that I was coming from a place where I could explain a little bit more about not just my situation, but the situation of kids like us generally. And the second audience that I wrote the book for, and this was one of the reasons why I organized the book like I did, was for people who are still on the fence, people who think, well, you know, it's a free country. I'm certainly not going to, you know, try and infringe upon the right of a gay person. But raising kids, it makes me uncomfortable. And so to that person, I wanted to answer a lot of the questions that they have. More broadly, you know, I wrote the book in very respectful, very careful language. That's something that I kind of disclose at the very beginning of the book is like, look, if you are an adamant supporter of same-sex marriage, this book isn't going to change your mind. But if you're willing to come to this issue with an open mind and a reasonable level of skepticism of both sides, then I think that I'm willing to answer the questions you're going to have.
Well, what's next for you?
And I'm also working on a project that I'm very excited about, and that's called Out to Dinner. And essentially what we're doing is we are inviting straight ally couples to host dinners to which they invite both a same-sex couple and somebody who's still kind of on the fence, those people that I was just talking about, and get together and just have dinner, not talk about politics or religion or the gay issue even, but to really just get to know each other and start building some relationships.
What do you feel that will accomplish?
I think by building these relationships and really getting to know people on a person-to-person level instead of some of these labels that get tossed around, we'll be able to move the conversation beyond, you know, this notion that there are some things that are, you know, inherently wrong. Some of the things that you mentioned at the very beginning of the segment, that there are these problems with gay people, problems with raising gay kids, and really kind of get into the heart of the matter, which is about marriage, and it's about, you know, respect and the inherent worth and dignity of all people.
One more question for you. I read in the book that you learned to tie a tie from an article in Playboy. Really?
That's right.
You really picked up Playboy for the article on
Well,
tie a tie?
I didn't pick it up to learn how to tie a tie, but it was definitely something I knew when I put it down.
I just wanted to clarify that. Zach Walls wrote about his family in his new book, My Two Moms, Lessons of Love, Strength, and What Makes a Family. And he joined us today from NPR member station WCQS in Asheville, North Carolina. Zach, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
And will you please wish your moms a happy Mother's Day from us?
Happy Mother's Day, Jackie and Terry. Love you guys both very, very much.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, you might have felt that sting when you didn't win that big lottery jackpot a few weeks ago, but our next guest says you might be better off without it. I know, hard to believe, but we'll hear why in just a few minutes. But first, we have a very different story about money and finance. You might know that May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and all this month we decided to talk to game changers who trace their heritage to that part of the world. These are people who have made a difference in fields like politics, culture, science, or sports. And we want to start our series with a man who is filling a new role in the U.S. government. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is a new government agency charged with overseeing banks, mortgage lenders, credit card companies, and so on, with a particular focus on representing the interests of consumers, as the name implies. And as part of that mission, the agency has created the Office of Minority and Women Inclusion, and the first person to fill that post is Stuart Ishimaro. He is a longtime civil rights leader and official, and he is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on the new post you just started.
Just started. Absolutely.
And I should mention you're a former commissioner of the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. You've also held in a former acting chair. You've held senior positions at the Justice Department and the Commission on Civil Rights. So clearly you have had a long time sort of focus on civil rights. What do you hope to do in this job?
Well, this is a very exciting job because it's focused on a certain sector. It's focused on the financial services sector, both for banks and non-banks. And we're going to take a close look to see how folks are doing in this area. And the beauty of this is that you get to focus. When I was at the EEOC, I got to focus on employment instead of civil rights writ large, and that was fun. And now I get to focus on a sector that has had issues over the years. And I think there are challenges in trying to figure out what's going on and how to actually do something about it.
The creation of your agency was mandated by the statute which created the agency overall. And as I understand it, you have a dual role. You're both to look out for diversity within your own agency, but also diversity in the financial sector overall.
Right.
But you don't have any regulatory authority over their hiring practices.
No, but, you know, I think starting off, you really need to know what the parameters are. And that's something that we need to figure out first of how people are doing, where the opportunities are, whether people are getting opportunities, both men and women, people of color as well. And a lot of that is sort of a missing element. And I'm hopeful that we can soon figure out what those parameters are and then try to figure out how do you get more people involved? How do you promote opportunities within the industry itself?
Why does diversity, particularly within this sector, matter?
Well, there's a couple reasons, I think. One is that the financial sector and the financial workings for all of us really does matter. And we saw during the financial crisis of 2008 the higher impact that it had on people of color and women and how quite often they have not been represented in these various sectors. And as I learned at the EEOC, the more people you get who are diverse in whatever business you're in, usually it makes for a better work product because there's different perspectives being brought to the table. And I think that as a starting point makes sense. You know, one thing that I've learned is that businesses quite often want to have those differing perspectives at the table.
It is also true that this financial crisis has many fathers, let's say, or mothers, if we want to be equal opportunity about it. And so it's still an open question whether at the root of it was regulation, at the root of it was aggressive business practices, ethics, or a lack of education among consumers. But it is a fact that there is fraud. A number of people perpetuating some of these financial frauds were people who preyed upon members of their own ethnic group. How will diversity address that question?
I think one of the things is that you can get a broader spectrum of ideas, opinions, perspectives on how people think, how do you market to people, how do you protect people to actually move their financial interests forward by having a broader group of people at the table. One of the difficult things with any industry is that quite often it gets narrowed down to like-thinking people. And one of the beauties of diversity, in my view, is by bringing different people who have not been involved in the past to the table, you get differing viewpoints. And I think that really helps the business model.
How do you know, though? What's the evidence of that?
If you look at how businesses are set up now in a globalized economy, you see people do things differently in different places. And I think we have learned from people who have operations overseas that because things are done differently than in this country, that can be very helpful. Part of this is quantitative on the numbers that are generated, and part of it is you're trying to reach a bigger segment of society, and that really can make a difference.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Stuart Ishimaru. He is the newly named head of the brand new Office of Minority and Women Inclusion at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We've talked on this program a number of times about how African Americans and Latinos were disproportionately affected by the housing crisis, and some studies show that there has been a tremendous loss of wealth in these groups as a result of this crisis. How does your office address a question like that when there's a disparate impact on a particular group, but it isn't really clear why?
Right. Well, you know, I think there are many parts of the Bureau that actually deal with this issue. My office is but one piece of this. We're looking to try to get increased diversity in the various sectors as well as within our own operation, both for employees and contractors. You know, part of this is educating people on what their rights are, what the parameters are of the financial world, that for many communities is something that they haven't dealt with in the past. I think that the Bureau will take strides to try to reach broader audiences than have been reached in the past, and I think that's a good thing.
As I mentioned earlier, you're a former head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and you have a very deep background in this area. Did you mind if we ask how you were drawn to it or why you were drawn to this particular area?
Well, you know, I always wanted to do good guy work, right? And during law school, I sort of stumbled into working on civil rights issues, and opportunities popped up. I was in the right place at the right time and have been very lucky over the course of years in being able to find jobs that would let me do civil rights type work. And this was yet another opportunity that popped up at the right time, and I'm looking forward to it.
Is there anything in your background or in your life experiences that you think pointed you on the path that you're now
on? You know, one thing was the whole experience of the Japanese Americans during World War II, before I was born. But, you know, my parents and their families were taken from California, put in camps. They were both put in camps in Utah and were kept there for the duration of the war. And the whole issue of civil liberties and civil rights being taken away during the wartime always affected me. And as you know, I saw in my later years that that was a fundamental defining experience for me. And the chance to give back in my work is very important.
On that whole question of taking liberties away, as you know, the agency for which you work, the agency overall, not your office in particular, has been hugely controversial at its creation, even though it's created by statute. But there have been continuous fights over what the scope of its authority should be. Those who oppose it say that they feel it's another example of kind of an overreaching federal government presence in the economic life of our country. Do you have a strategy for alleviating the skeptics?
Well, what I'm hopeful is that what we do over the course of my tenure there will be thoughtful and that we'll listen to a lot of people, we'll crunch a lot of numbers and issues and come out hopefully with a solution that works at the end of the day.
How will you know that you have succeeded in this job?
Well, part of it will be metrics. Part of it will be looking at the progress you've made, things you can measure. You can see what sorts of changes companies have made in their processes. You can see whether people have actually been hired or not, whether they've set goals that make sense. It's not all in the numbers. Part of it is in atmosphere as well within the organization to see whether various organizations have become more open, more welcoming to various people who haven't been there in the past. And that's a real challenge.
Stuart Ishimaru is the new head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's Office of Minority and Women Inclusion, and he was kind enough to join us in our offices in Washington, D.C. Stuart Ishimaru, thank you so much for speaking with us. I hope we'll speak again.
Thanks, Michelle.
We turn now from consumer protection to personal finance. It's been weeks since that huge lottery jackpot made just a few people millionaires and left many of the rest of us with worthless tickets stuffed in our junk drawers. But if the disappointment of not being a few $100 million richer is still on your mind, this conversation is for you. If you're still contemplating the fantasy of what you could do with money like that, college and retirement funds paid up, a second home, shopping sprees, a life with no worries, our next guest says that old cliche really is true. Mo money, mo problems. And he says he should know because he is a financial and legal advisor to the very wealthy. He has a new book out. It's called Fables of Fortune, What Rich People Have That You Don't Want. His name is Richard Watts, and he is with us now. Mr. Watts, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you for asking me.
Now, you know, Mr. Watts, let me just say that the first thing I bet is on a lot of people's minds is not the troubles of the wealthy. It's the trouble of getting by, you know, trying to make sure that their kids are educated, that the mortgage is, you know, paid every month. So, you know, given the economic troubles that we've been having in this country and also around the world. So what's your thought about why this is the right time for this book?
Well, I really don't think that the book was meant to expose or to be an expose of wealthy people, but really to talk to the middle class and to say to the middle class, you spend an awful lot of your time dreaming about things you probably will not have. And I can tell you that once you get to what you call the promised land, it may not be as good as you think.
You do not pull any punches in this book, you know, I have to say. And one of the things that you are very blunt about is how wealth can unravel and compromise marriages. For example, you write, when you wake up at night and see your spouse sleeping next to you, what do you see? Has she stood by you for a long time? Has he done his best to provide you with a worthwhile life? Has he or she made you feel like you deserve to be alive and loved? You talk about the fact that oftentimes significant wealth can compromise a marriage. And I think a lot of people might be surprised by that because they would think that if you don't have money worries, what do you have to fight about? Tell us why it is that you have found in your experience that significant wealth can really compromise those relationships.
Well, there's two sides of that, Michelle. The first part of that is people that become wealthy with their wives. And then there's those people that have been divorced and are now trying to find new wives that have wealth. The first one is just the issue of when a lot of money comes to play, husband and or wife, whoever made the money, has their time taken more and more and more. It reminds me of the time when I saw the CEO of a very large Fortune 500 company sitting on the beach with his kids playing in Hawaii, and he did nothing but tend to two iPads two phones and a laptop that he had the entire time he was sitting on the beach. That's all he did. And so there's this sense that we're growing apart. We don't have the same direction anymore. And frankly, we have the money to be able to afford to divorce each other. The second side of that is the husband or wife who's divorced now. So now you've got a single person going out to the marketplace and looking for love. And the people that are usually interested in them become very interested in them. And it doesn't seem like it's because of their money. But somewhere in the process, oftentimes, and I would say most times, they knew of that person because they had money. And they headed in that direction to make sure that if that particular person that's interested in being married, I'm talking about the non-wealthy person, the have-not, is closing in on someone, they want to make sure that if they married for love the first time, they want to make sure that they have lots of money the second time.
Hmm. You also talk about kids, you know, how children can be affected by wealth. And some of the stories you talk about, the sense of entitlement, are really sickening. You know, just and things that you might expect, you know, kids just going off and just buying, you know, whatever, and parents just setting no boundaries at all because it doesn't affect their financial bottom line. But one of the, I think, the most powerful stories in the book is your own, where you talked about how one of your sons racked up thousands of dollars in credit card debt without your knowledge and thought you would bail him out, and you didn't. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, that was my son, Todd. He was at University of Southern California. We put him on a budget, and the lifestyle that he was wanted to engage there with a lot of the kids that were there was more than he could afford. And so without telling us, he basically started taking every credit card that was offered to him, and by the time he graduated, he had $48,000 in debt, in addition to the things that he had obligations for with regard to his school. And it was horrific, and it created a situation where my wife and I sat looking at each other, and my wife said, he's a great kid, he got great grades, he's going on to graduate school, pay it off. Just write a check and pay it off. And I said, first of all, I can't do that, and second of all, I won't do that. And we made him pay, and over the next years, he lived with four guys in an apartment. He had very little he could do for 4 years. He went on to school, a graduate school, and now he's got a job, and he has paid that off. And at the very end, he wrote a check. I told him if he ever got a bonus, he would have to use the entire bonus to pay the balance off, which he did. And he and I were both in tears when we watched after 4 years that balance go to zero. He said, I never felt so good to be poor, Dad.
I'm speaking with Richard Watts. He's the author of the new book, Fables of Fortune, What Rich People Have That You Don't Want. It chronicles some of the difficulties that extreme wealth can actually cause with or bring to people and their families. So what about people who are struggling to pay their mortgage? People that are probably listening to our conversation and are struggling to pay their mortgages or struggling to keep the kids' college funds funded so that kids can have some choices, you know, later on, or struggling to make sure that they have something to live on in retirement. You know, what's your message for them?
Well, you know, there are varying different levels of where people are. And certainly people that aren't eating and don't have a roof over their head, I feel awful for them and feel that they are entitled to gain whatever they can from life to put themselves out of that position. What I'm really aiming at is the middle, the people that are making $75,000, I think Time Magazine said, and above, the people that really have the opportunity to live on what they have. And my message to them is it's probably best for you to quit dreaming about something you will probably never have, but to really recognize the blessings of where you're at and what you've got, and just to enjoy the things that you've got, because there's things you've got that the wealthiest families in America can't get.
Finally, have you ever met anybody or worked with anybody who can have their cake and eat it too? Can you be wealthy and not wind up with all these problems that you talk about in the book, bratty kids, you know, entitled spouses that you're not really sure what their motives are? I just want to be ready in case Powerball comes through.
I speak about that in the book on several occasions, that there are people that do this, but the very interesting thing is that what they do with the money is they begin to use it as a security blanket. And they don't use it in order to elevate their lifestyle. So the ones that have been successful at it have done it basically to create security. And the Warren Buffetts of the world, when they get to a place where they can have anything, they don't allow themselves to have anything. And they make sure that they continue to echo to themselves that this was never about having jets and 15 homes and having more than I could possibly own in the way of a wardrobe and house in one place. It's really about the journey, and it's about security. And so they put themselves in a position where they want something in the future instead of putting themselves in a position where anything they dream, they go get.
Richard Watts is the author of the new book, Fables of Fortune, What Rich People Have That You Don't Want. He joined us from Costa Mesa, California. Mr. Watts, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Michelle, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we want to pay tribute to the man who showed generations of children where the wild things are, author Maurice Sendak. He just passed away, and we want to tell you more about him in just a few minutes. But first, they say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Today, though, since Mother's Day is coming up, we thought it would be fun to hear from people who have really earned their stripes in the parenting department. We are talking grandmothers. On the surface, being a grandma seems like a pretty easy gig. Visit your cute grandkids, let them stay up late, give them all the candy they want, and hand them right back. Of course, that's far from the whole truth for many grandparents now. Many are providing child care or financial assistance, and a rising number of grandparents, more than 6 million now, have grandchildren who live with them full time, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. So with us today are four grandmothers. Barbara Graham is a grandmother of two. She's also editor of Eye of My Heart. That's a collection of essays about the pleasures and pains of being a grandparent. We talked with her earlier about that book. Also with us, Myra Patner. She is a grandmother of five. And we want to tell you the truth. It was her gentle nudge that led to this idea. She sent us a note saying, how about hearing from some more grandmothers? Also with us, Marita Golden. She is an award-winning essayist and author of more than 10 books. She's also a grandmother of three. And she was just a judge in the prestigious Penn Faulkner Award. Words talk about having it all and doing it all. And we hope to hear from another grandma who is raising her kid, her grandchildren full time. We'll see about that. Welcome, ladies, grandmothers. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Barbara Graham, I'm going to start with you. I just want to remind people about the essay you wrote for your own book, and you also collected the essays of other grandparents. What gave you that idea?
Well, as soon as I became a grandmother, I was flooded with feeling, flooded with love, overwhelmed. I knew I would love this little being, but I didn't know that I would be like a teenager with her first crush. And as a writer, the way I make sense of life and the way I make sense of the world is to write about it. So, and I also started talking to lots of other grandmothers, and everybody has a story who is a grandparent. So that was really what triggered it.
Mari, I want to also say thank you for your very nice note. A very direct note, though, saying that, you know, people pay lip service to the wisdom of grandparents, but then they ignore what they have to say. And I just wondered, you know, do you think that's ageism or is there something else to that, you think?
You know, I've pondered that and I have not come up with an answer to it. Maybe Barbara can help me come up with an answer because I'm sure you've thought about that, too. I don't know. I don't really know why, and I don't know if it's just because of this is the world we're living in now, a world of youth and high energy where people don't get sick. I mean, let's face it, as a grandmother, you're not in a number one young shape that you were when you were having babies in your 20s. Your knee has to be replaced. You're this, you're that. I mean, you have to go to doctors. It almost becomes a half-time job to take care of yourself.
Take care of yourself.
So I don't know whether that idea is secretly in the back of people's minds. I don't know. Barbara, what do you think?
Well, I would also say that when you become a grandparent, the metaphor I like to use is that you go from being a member, this is baseball, of the starting lineup to it's like being a relief pitcher on the bench. And what you have to realize, and it takes some realization, is that you're not in charge anymore. The parents are in charge.
Yeah.
And at once, as we had to find our own way as parents, we have to allow our children to find their own way too. And I think an interesting piece these days is the internet. The amount of information available to new parents on the internet, they can find out everything they want by just clicking
and
on the mouse.
Don't have to ask you. Maria, you know,
That's an interesting point.
It is an interesting point, but get ready because I'm going to ask you to lay some grandma wisdom on us anyway. So you know, get ready for that. So this is your shot. Make sure you don't miss it. Marita Golden, I wanted to ask you, I'm so glad you were able to join us. And congratulations also on all your many, many awards. Do you feel, as an African-American, though, you know, African-American grandmothers are kind of have a storied place both in the culture and in the literature? Not just African-Americans, a lot of other cultures do, too. But do you feel, I don't know, a little extra pressure to be the perfect grandma, to live up to that image that many people have, or what role you should play in your family?
Well, I think that because I think all African-American families, no matter their economic or sociological status, are under a different kind of pressure than other families in this country, and are often, the pressure is often subliminal. It's overt. It's covert. And I think as a grandmother, I feel very responsible about schooling my grandchildren, who are actually my step-grandchildren, about the world that they are a part of. So, for example, when my 17-year-old granddaughter graduates from high school this June, as she will, and then heads off to historically black college, you know, I'm going to talk to her about, you know, leadership and carrying on some of the work that I've tried to do, and her role as a young African-American woman in the African-American community. So as a grandmother, I'm going to have conversations with her that maybe, quite frankly, her mother doesn't have time for. Her mother's got three children. She's working. She's juggling a lot of things. And that's the kind of role that my husband and I find ourselves in, having these conversations with our grandchildren that, quite frankly, you know, the parents sometimes don't have time to have, because we have that long view of life.
And, yeah, passing on heritage.
Exactly.
Jacqueline Laird, though, you are, as we mentioned earlier, doing your second tour of duty in the parenting, the primary parenting role. You're the full-time caregiver for three of your grandchildren. You have 12 overall. I just wanted to ask how the second time around, and I understand that the circumstances that led you to this place were not the happiest ones, so I want to acknowledge that. But the second time around, do you feel more confident in some ways, or do you feel perhaps less so, perhaps less isolated, a little more scared?
It's definitely much more frightening. I think comparatively there are many, many, many more dangers out there, as is expressed with the internet, you know. And I mean, it's tough. It's tough. I used to doubt the wisdom of raising our children when we were so young. And I thought, why don't we wait till we're older and wiser? Oh, boy. Don't question the way things are, because you don't know. I'm telling you. It's really hard. And it's really hard also the fact that you're a mother, and then you're a grandmother, and then you're a great-grandmother. Well, unfortunately, with these children, I don't get the grand part. That's been taken away.
Is the hardest part the financial piece, the financial pressure? Is it the physical toll? I mean, because Myra was talking about that. The fact is, you know, you are in a different place physically than you would have been, you know, 20 years ago. Which is the hardest for you, if you don't mind my telling us?
I think that if I won the lottery and had all the money in the world, it would still be very, very frightening. So I probably would have to say the hardest part is the emotional part, the frightening part. Just because you did it once doesn't mean you know what you're doing. Trust me. Trust me. And I hope that I'm not going to have to do this till I get it right, because I'm really scared.
We're having our weekly parenting conversation. We decided, for in honor of Mother's Day, to go to those who really earned their stripes. We're having a roundtable of grandmothers. We're talking with Jacqueline Laird. That's who was speaking just now. She's a grandmother of 12. She truly wears the crown, including three who live with her. Also with us, Barbara Graham, editor of Eye of My Heart, a collection of essays about grandmothers from grandmothers. She has two grandchildren. Myra Patner is a grandmother of 5 and wrote us a very nice note saying, how come we don't hear from more grandmas? And also the award-winning author Marita Golden. And on the upside, Marita, you were telling us that and you've actually written about the fact that your being a grandmother has some ways smoothed relationships with your adult stepdaughter. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I, thanks to my stepdaughter, because we have a blended family, I'm the grandmother of 3, and they range in age from a year and a half to 17. And so, you know, this whole thing of being a stepmother is very dicey. and you're going to be the greatest stepmother in the world. And then when there's a little resistance, you know, it doesn't quite work out. But when my stepdaughter had her second child, it was a lot of, you know, sort of difficulty with the birth, and it was an early birth. And during the time when my grandson was in the incubator, there was a moment when we were alone in the hospital room, and I shared with her because she was very fearful about what would happen, and there was a lot of fear and anxiety. And I shared with her my own experience of losing a child. And so I knew what that was like. I had had a premature birth that, unfortunately, you know, the infant died. But I shared with her all the pain, the grief that I felt, and just shared with her that I knew what she was going through. Mm. And even though it did not seem at all that that was going to be the prognosis for Vaughn, she was afraid that it would be, and she just didn't know what to do with all these feelings. And I think that it was very comforting for her to know, as a stepmother who we'd had some challenges in our relationship, that I could access her feelings at that moment.
Sure.
And that sort of opened up a space where from that point on there was a little more intimacy. And these grandchildren, I think, are these wonderful sort of beings that come into our lives, and they have a mission, and that mission is to open our hearts if we will let them. I mean, as Barbara was saying earlier, that you turn into this person who has a crush on, you know, like I have a crush now on my year and a half old granddaughter, and you just turn into silly putty. It's quite wonderful.
Well, Myra, you also have mentioned that you've had not always the easiest time, but give us we've got about 3 minutes left, and want to hear from the group if we can. What's your best bit of grandma advice?
Well, the hardest thing for me is to keep my mouth shut. I'm a blurter, and I have to keep my mouth shut, and I have to not say it, and I want to say it, and if I say it, I get in trouble, and then I have to retract it, and so I'm trying not to say it. That's the hardest thing for me.
You can tell me. You can give me any. Here's the event. I'm old enough that I'm too old to rebel. You can tell me anything that I'm doing wrong. I'm happy to hear it. Barbara, what about you? You've done a deep study of your own life as a grandma, and then you've talked to all these other grandmothers about their experience. What's your best bit of grandma advice?
I would say curb your expectations, but not your enthusiasm. Life throws a lot of punches your way. I was a local grandmother in the beginning, and then my kids moved overseas, and they had the nerve to kidnap their baby and take her with her. And
that wasn't there.
Out of my neighborhood. So really, it's you're not in charge anymore. So you have to kind of bow to the parents, figure out how to be in their lives, in the kids' lives. If you're a long-distance grandparent, sometimes it's a little bit different if you're the mother of the father versus the mother of the mother.
Yes.
There are all kinds of issues. And then, especially in this world of blended families, there might be three or four grandmothers in the same family, and it can arouse feelings of junior high school flashback competition. But really, you know, the heart is a very generous muscle. And so you need to trust and believe that you will find your place and just enjoy. I mean, there is enough love to go around.
Yes. You're going to make me cry. That would not be pretty. Jackie, I'm going to ask you to give you the final word. We only have a minute left. I apologize. What would make your life better as grandma doing the second tour of duty? Is it recognizing your role? Is it having people recognize? What do you? I know it's a tough question to ask and to answer in a minute, but what would be better?
Oh boy, just always, always tell them you love them. Always, always tell them you love them.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it through once. I can do this again. I can do this. I am old, but I'm tough.
Yeah, yeah. That is true. We're tough.
You've got the collective good wishes of all of your folks here. And can I say, just on behalf of all children everywhere,
yeah,
thank you for your service. And happy Mother's Day to all of the moms. Barbara Graham, grandmom of two, editor of Eye of My Heart, a collection of essays about the pleasures and perils of being a grandparent. Myra Patner, grandmother of five, very kind enough to join us in our GC. Thank you for your note. Do come back and see us.
Thank you for listening.
Jacqueline Laird is the grandmother of 12, including three who live with us. She was with us from Station KPFK in North Hollywood, California. And Marita Golden, an award-winning author, grandmother of three, with us on the line from her home office in Maryland. Thank you all so much.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
It's fun.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Finally, today we want to honor someone whose work fired the imaginations of many children and their parents. Award-winning author and illustrator Maurice Sendak died today at the age of 83. Maurice Sendak is best known for that classic children's book, Where the Wild Things Are. He wrote and illustrated the story of the mischievous hero, Max, who gets sent to bed without dinner, and his imagination takes him to a land of colorful giant monsters. Where the Wild Things Are was a huge hit when it was published in 1963, earning Maurice Sendak international acclaim and a Caldecott Medal. Sendak's other titles include In the Night Kitchen, Outside Over There, Chicken Soup with Rice, and the recently published Bumble Artie. Sendak was born June 10, 1928, a year before the Great Depression. Sendak's parents were Jewish Polish immigrants, and much of his extended family died in Nazi concentration camps. Sendak often said he didn't have a happy childhood. Here's a clip from an interview he did with NPR's Steve Inskeep in 2006.
I think it is unnatural to think that there is such a thing as a blue sky, white clouded, happy childhood for anybody. Childhood is a very, very tricky business of surviving it.
My brother's book, a book written and illustrated by Sendak, is scheduled to be published next February. And we want to leave you with a reading by NPR's Tom Cole of Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are.
Max said, "Be still," and tamed them with the magic trick of staring into all their yellow eyes without blinking once. And they were frightened and called him the most wild thing of all, and made him king of all wild things. "And now," cried Max, "let the wild rumpus start."
That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.